I'm Kevin Kelly. The show is Live and Local, your connection to local music and more. Archie Greene was a folklorist, labor lorist, and union activist, and many other things. And he had an affiliation with the University of Illinois back in the 60s into the 70s. And the University of Illinois is going to pay tribute to him this evening in a very special presentation. One of the participants in that presentation is Stephen Wade, himself an American folk musician, writer, researcher. Stephen is with us today to talk about some of the musical influences of Archie Greene, his influence on music and the other way around, and also play a bit for us in illustration. And we'll find out what this is all about coming up very shortly here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. That was music by William Grant Still from a collection of short pieces called The American Scene. In this case, it came from a suite that he called The Southwest, a movement called The Song of the Rivermen. And the Manhattan Chamber Orchestra performed it here under the leadership of Richard Alden Clark, who has made a bit of a specialty, or at least made a lot of recordings of William Grant Still's music. And you're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. I think a different kind of show for you today. It has to do with an event, or it anticipates an event that is happening tonight on the campus of the University of Illinois School of Music, sponsored by the School of Labor and Employment Relations. I'm very used to referring to the School of Music on this largely music program. And that's going to be in the Wagner Education Center at the School of Labor and Employment Relations on East Armory in Champaign. It runs from 7 to 9 tonight. And it has to do with folklorist or labor lorist, or you can put a whole bunch of other tags on him, apparently, Archie Greene, who spent some time at the University of Illinois a few decades ago and continued to have a relationship with us in part because, I say us because the WILL is in fact affiliated with the University of Illinois, because he's published some books through the press here. Judy McCullough is with us. She is a longtime friend of his and also publisher of some of those books, editor of some of those books. And also with us, Stephen Wade, who is himself a folklorist, musician, writer, researcher, and knew Archie Greene and spent a lot of time researching his activities. And so I'm going to just start by asking this question, because even though I've read some about Archie Greene, his life seems to have been so wide-reaching that I can't say that I've wrapped my brain around him at all. So either or both of you chime in and see if you can just answer this. Who was Archie Greene, and why should those music lovers who listen to this show particularly care about him?
Well, Archie was a pioneer. He was in the studies of music, and I'll tell you about that a second. Archie grew up in in California. He was a working man. He was a shipwright, and he kept his union membership all his life, and didn't enter academia. He was 40 years old when he came here. He'd gone to Berkeley, and then after straight out of the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, he went into the shipyards there in San Francisco Harbor there, and learned that trade, and all the while he was a worker at an intellectual, and he studied things, and he was drawn to the music. There was a man out in California who sang the Big Rock Candy Mountain, Harry McClintock. And he got to know him. And Mac McClintock had a kind of a hit with that song. A lot of people heard it. And Archie started, that wasn't necessarily the first song that Archie studied, but he looked into that, and looked into this artist, and he was thinking about records. And he knew people like Norman Granz, who was the jazz impresario and made records of many musicians too. And there was another person, Archie, sort of self-taught, a brilliant man, an etymologist by the name of Peter Tammany, who was documenting thousands of locutions and words. And Archie was studying all that, working at the same time in these yards. And he came here, I guess, to get a degree in library science.
Yeah, he came in 1958 and got a Master of Library Science degree. I was the labor librarian at what used to be ILIR, the Institute of Labor and Industry Relations. The name has since changed.
That's what I wanted to keep referring to this.
Yeah, people still do, actually. Yeah. And in the midst of that, he went back to the University of Pennsylvania to get his PhD in folklore, because although he knew more than some of the credentialed folklorists, he didn't have his union card, as it were, and a few folklorists would not take him seriously until he got his PhD. So he did that. He wrote a splendid dissertation about coal mining songs, 16 tons, coal miners' blues, dark as a dungeon, and quite a few others. And that became his first book later, called Only a Miner, which the University of Illinois Press published. And Archie came back. He taught in the English department also. He taught courses in the radical novel and in ballad and folk song. And then left in, I believe, 1972 for the University of Texas, where he retired about 10 years later.
I want to go back before you continue, because I'm still stuck on the transition from shipwright to library and information science.
Well, think about a shipwright drawing out his blueprint and organizing his knowledge and his traditions. And Archie brought those same skills to his academic work and this organization, and as well as his interest and respect. He coined that term labor lore, one word, and he valued that so much. I mean, I have pieces of paper at home where he would set out diagrams of how he wanted me to study songs, and it really is a schematic, is what it is, and so that's how he would think. So he brought together these realms, which really we might not think of as united, but a good shipwright has to organize his thinking, and he might draw it on the back of a brown paper bag with a stubby pencil, but so does a good librarian, good reference librarian, figuring out where all the secrets are and all the archival treasures might be, those raw materials, and organize them so somebody else can learn from it. And so it really isn't inconsistent. It's just sort of surprising. And so when Judy had mentioned this, she spoke at the Library of Congress just a few days ago in Washington about Archie's work in Only a Miner, in that book, how he would take a record and look at the grooves in the record and just explore outward who listened to this record, who were the A&R men, what is being said on this record, what styles inform it, and so on. And so it just, he had an enormously interesting and organized way of thinking. He was constantly pushing that envelope at the same time. His wife said that he made himself think large.
So...
One of his earliest mentors on the waterfront in the Bay Area was a Clydesider, an old shipwright from Scotland, who was a mentor in ideological terms, in terms of broad ideas about workers and the value of work, the significance of work, and also the traditions that were handed down through generations of shipwrights in the old country and then increasingly in the new country. And also, Archie absorbed from him a great sense of detail, how to construct a ship, what the angles were so that the water would roll off the deck right, and yet the ship would not founder. And it was this combination of very broad vision and detail. Part of the detail was in words, what words conveyed. A single word might be exceedingly packed with significance for somebody who knew what protest movement it represented, perhaps, in the old country, or what part of a job ritual it might represent. And he got fascinated by words and by language and by how people approached communication. And it was in that connection, partly, that he went into library science. It was also a degree that he could get to enter academic life, which he had been out of for quite some time. And so when he came here, he went to library school, got his degree, and then went to work at ILIR at the Labor Institute.
Right, teaching there. So we left off then 1972 after he left the university, having taught here for about a decade. Mm-hmm. And then to Texas, you said.
He went to Texas, and he retired from there. He had a vision, really, that was larger than academic life, and increasingly he got involved with what we call public folklore, preservation and presentation of traditions that can be found in any community, any ethnic group, any occupational group in the country, a group defined by language, by religion, by locality, and was the father, if anybody could be said to be the father of the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. It's now a very well established a unit at the library. It operates the Veterans History Project, and StoryCorps is affiliated with it that you broadcast here on Friday mornings.
Sure, from NPR.
Yeah. He was involved with that. But he on his own, lived in Washington, essentially working on unemployment, but walking the halls of Congress. He stopped in every congressional office in the Senate and the House side. He knew every representative elected. He knew all the staffers. He knew their ethnic backgrounds. He knew what turned them on musically, or in the Witchinaka on the Wall, or whatever it might be. And when the third bill to establish an American Folklife Center finally passed, it was by unanimous vote of both houses of Congress. It was beyond Republican or Democrat. It was really a gift to the American people.
I can't imagine that happening anymore.
Yeah, it was quite amazing. That was in 1976. On January 2nd, that Gerald Ford signed that law into that bill into
the American Folklife Preservation Act.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Archie wrote it.
Yeah.
That's his language.
And among other things, that's what created the American Folklife Center in the
world. Oh, yes. Yeah.
So where does, Stephen, let me back up. And
sure.
For those who are just tuning into the show, this is Live and Local on FM 90.9. And we build this as your connection to local music and more. We're getting the more, but we will also have some music on the show because Stephen Waite is with us. He's a folk musician, writer, researcher, and giving part of the presentation tonight at the University of Illinois on in tribute to Archie Green. Also with us, Judy McCullough, formerly of the University of Illinois Press, friend of Archie Green's and his editor of a few of his books. And Stephen, you brought your banjo along.
I did. Well, you know, I guess the connection here to Archie is that I was Archie would come up to Chicago. That's where I was born and raised. And in 1965, I was almost 12 years old when I first saw him at the University of Chicago Folk Festival introducing Sarah Ogan Gunning, the ballad singer from Kentucky. And he was the most amazing person. I remember being struck so much by the way he would talk about the music. It was, again, back to that workman, that sense of the internal parts of the craft. He wasn't talking romantically about these people. He was talking viscerally and how they were making their decisions and what was going on inside that music. And I just remember, being dazzled by this person, and he just seemed very familiar to me in certain ways and very different in other ways. I'd seen people like him in years earlier in Band the Bomb marches and things like that, but here he was talking, and then I got to know him. So I've knew him much of my life, and he finally in later years he'd come when he'd come to Washington where I live. He'd stay with us, and he's very much guided me in my music studies and the work that I've turned to. I was a full-time performer for 25 years, and did a one-man show called Banjo Dancing that played all over, and I did some other one-man shows also. But in moving, finding other creative outlets, it was really Archie who helped me in just sort of expanding that work into more writing and things like that. So it meant a great deal to me. One of the musicians that Archie visited in the 60s was a man I came to know, and he was on the Grand Ole Opry. And when I met him, his name was Kirk McGee. And he and his brother Sam and Kirk McGee were accompanists to Uncle Dave Macon, who was the first star of the Grand Ole Opry. Well, when I met Kirk, he'd been on the Opry for about 56 years. He was the longest living player on the show. And I visited him. He played on the Opry every weekend, and he also worked at had a real estate operation going there, a real estate office he worked at in Franklin, Tennessee, where he had grown up. And this is a tune that he played, and he showed me. That's a piece that Kirk called Snowdrop. And so if Archie, if he was guiding me right now to think about it, he'd say, well, where did that come from? And there was a basis to that song. There's an earlier piece that was done in mid-19th century, the Spanish Fandango. And this was a piece that all the guitar players and then the banjo players picked up. And this is sort of a variant of it. And this is saying that Kirk learned from a family member. And so this thing goes roots deep into the 19th century. So if we're thinking in terms of what Archie would expect of exploring this tune, we'd talk to why did Kirk play it? Where did he play it? Who did he learn it from? What traditions does it represent? What all of these things. What does it mean to have, what was happening physically to the instrument, to the banjo, that you'd be playing chords and playing notes up the neck and have frets and things. The earlier banjos didn't have that, so this kind of music wasn't being, this kind of tune wasn't being played. And so there's just, and I'm just making this up on the spot. I hadn't thought about this tune this way at all until this moment so much. But the thing is that these are kinds of inquiry that he would inspire, that Archie would want and expect.
Sounds like a highly questioning person, and just raising questions after questions about all kinds of topics.
Well, I once called him Socrates in a T-shirt.
Yeah, I saw that in one of your articles.
Yeah. Well, he was.
That's true. Yeah. He was.
And I saw it. It was in the halls at the Library of Congress, this enormously gilded place. I mean, it's this beautiful public building in Washington, for sure. And there are all these folklorists and people gathered around him. And there he was, just, you know, this handout, you know, explaining something to them, and they're watching him with complete love in their eyes and fascination and devotion, and he was leading them down the byways of thought in that hallway there, and I just, that's all, that's what I saw, and I still think of him that way. I told him that. He was mildly amused by it. He accepted that.
The Socrates in a T-shirt.
You know, he wasn't too impressed, but he I think he appreciated it. He knew I loved him, you know.
Well, in your presentation tonight, Stephen, part of this tribute to and remembrance of Archie Greene, because what we haven't mentioned is he died in March, which is the impetus for this event tonight. And I will say that it starts at 7 o'clock. If you're just tuning in, I'm not sure we mentioned it anytime recently here. The tribute to Archie Greene is tonight from 7 to 9. On the University of Illinois campus in Champaign at the Wagner Education Center at the School of Labor and Employment Relations, formerly ILIR, and that is on East Armory Avenue. And if you want more information, you can go to news.illinois.edu/news and search for Archie Greene, because there's too many other numbers and letters after this to find that website. So, in your presentation tonight, Stephen Wade, along with Jordan Kay.
Yeah, he's
and
wonderful.
His Prairie Dogs.
You know him?
Yeah.
A great band. And he's a real local musician and plays all over here. Last night he was showing us some of his he has these enormous ring binders. I mean, more than a half a dozen of them. I mean, things are 3 inches thick. Of this guy's repertoire is amazing. He's a working musician.
Jordan. And,
Jordan, he knows his stuff. And, I wrote something for tonight, a 20-minute piece, and Jordan's going to play in it, and I'm going to play, and I'm going to talk, sort of explore another piece of music, sort, I guess, much further than what we just did with Snowdrop, but, you know.
Well, give us a teaser from there, if you can, a little more from that piece, maybe. Can you do that?
Well, no. They'll just have to come. I'm in a different tuning on that. It would be too much.
But you could say what it is.
Well, it's a piece of, I call it How Archie Taught Us to Learn from Music. And it's about, when he was here at Illinois, we found the manuscript in Judy's files. He had produced a record called Tipple, Loom, and Rail. And this is a record, and it came out on Folkways.
What are those first two words?
Tipple, Loom, and Rail. Three different industries. And Mike Seeger, who just passed away, was the musician on it. Archie wrote the notes to this. This is one extensive brochure that went inside this LP. Judy over here edited the notes. Anyway, he did this in 1965. We found it was July 28th. He finished it and said University of Illinois, ILIR, on his manuscript that's in our inner file cabinet there. And he wrote about, you know, notes to these songs, backgrounds and responses. The last song in the album was an unusual version of a very familiar song on the song about John Henry. It's called The Death of John Henry. And in fact, it was recorded by Uncle Dave Macon, who I mentioned before, who Sam and Kirk McGee played with. And when Uncle Dave recorded it, he first recorded in 1926, and Sam McGee, Kirk's older brother, was playing the guitar behind him. And so I just sort of take that song apart a little bit and then go someplace with it and exploring it. And I've got sort of a film clip. There's only one piece of film of Uncle Dave Macon, and it's from a great B-movie that was done by Republic Pictures in 1940 called Grand Ole Opry. And in it, he plays and flips the banjo around, does all kinds of stuff. And I just sort of follow a kind of course into that song, and just sort of something I learned in the course of trying to understand it, into some other songs from Uncle Dave's first recording session a couple years earlier, 1924. And so anyway, that's what I'll be doing, and with Jordan.
And you brought to the show with you, you brought some recorded examples.
Yeah.
Why don't you lead us into the first one of those?
Yeah. Well, again, thinking about Archie and Illinois here, in October 1963, a Southwestern Virginia musician named Hobart Smith came and played here for your campus folk song club. Judy was at that concert. Archie was at that concert. And they put it together, the campus folk song club. And Hobart had come on a two-week trip from Saltville, Virginia, where he lived, to play at do a concert at the Old Town School of Folk Music. And he stayed with my teacher, Fleming Brown, the man whose banjo that I'm holding. This was his banjo. And Hobart stayed with Fleming, and Fleming made the most extensive recordings of Hobart anyone ever did. He was first recorded by Library of Congress in 1942, but they were both banjo players and just found a trust and a comfort level with each other, and they made about 9 hours of tapes, and before Fleming died, he handed me those tapes, said, do something with this, put this out, take care of it, most of all. And it was enormous, you know, in a sense, grief in his eyes, because he knew how important it was, what these tapes meant to him about Hobart Smith and how important this music was. And so Hobart, and I did that for Smithsonian, and that's what this record is. It's called In Sacred Trust. And the reason why I called it that had to do with the fact that, well, there was this sort of responsibility I had with these tapes. And then, as you can hear throughout the course of that record, or really throughout the course of that recording session, the trust those two men had for each other. But on a more profound level of all, Hobart, who was born in the end of the 19th century, he was learning from men who were alive during the Civil War. And obviously the only thing he had to remember their music by was with his memory and his desire. Certainly didn't have a tape recorder. It didn't exist. And he, you know, he wasn't about reading and writing. He was about an oral memory. And he was an extraordinary player. He didn't just play the banjo. He played the banjo. He played the fiddle. He played the guitar. He played the piano. He played the mandolin, you know, and he played the harmonica, and on and on and on. And the piece that we've got queued up now is him playing the piano, and you'll hear it. It'll sound just like a five-string banjo. Fly Around My Pretty Little Miss. So when Hobart played that at Fleming's house, at Fleming Brown's house on his piano, he played here the same week, here at Urbana for the Campus Folk Song Club. So that happened right at that moment, essentially, you know, a few hours later, really.
And Judy McCullough, who's with us today, just described that as one of Archie Greene's babies,
Folk Song Club. Yes, in its heyday, it was most active from the early to the mid-1960s. It was the largest voluntary organization on campus at the University of Illinois, and put on concerts, a lecture series, put out three LPs, did reprints, had a newsletter, periodic folk sings where all kinds of people came. John Harford lived over in Clinton at the time he came, and traditional music musicians as well as students and others who picked up traditional songs because they were so captivated by them. I should say that it was a great gesture between town and gown, which was unusual for that time. There were many townspeople who were involved in the Campus Folk Song Club, and so many students came through that training ground, as it were. Archie was a terrific teacher outside the classroom as well as inside the classroom, and they still revere him and remember him, and his example lives on. That's one of the enormous contributions he made to us. You asked why we should care, and that indeed is one reason we should care. He was a master teacher.
Well, and I particularly asked, why should music lovers care? Mm-hmm. And I see that Stephen has pulled out his guitar pick, which makes me think he's about to play something for us.
Well, I was just thinking, yeah. I haven't done it in a long time, but I thought I'd try that Fly Around My Pretty Little Miss.
It was fun to watch you do that because you said initially, I haven't done that in a long time, and at first you looked unsure, and then as far as you got into it, the more, hey, I'm doing this. I remember it all. I'm doing great, aren't I?
Well, that wasn't that was my mental thought process.
Well, I don't know what it was, but that's what it kind of looked like. That's my interpretation. You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. Our show is made possible with support from the Music Shop and Pro Sound Center, now in their new location at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign. The Music Shop offers private lessons on all instruments in their brand new studios. They also provide a complete band and orchestra instrument repair and service department. And we're talking on the show today with Stephen Wade, American folk musician and performer in various one-man shows, which I want to talk about in a minute, and also Judy McCullough, former executive editor at the University of Illinois Press and editor of a number of books by Archie Greene, who taught on the University of Illinois campus for 12-plus years or so back in the 60s and early 70s, and actually got a degree from here. And got himself involved in so many things. I'm just looking at instructor, union activist, folklorist, and there are so many other nouns, descriptive nouns that can be applied to him. It's sort of mind-boggling, all of the things that he got himself involved in. But I wonder if you can summarize a little bit more what was the role of music in his various activities, particularly later on, as he got more into writing about many aspects of labor and labor lore and folklore, and it's sort of a mind-bogglingly large topic.
Mm-hmm. One of the great contributions he made where he did pioneering work with music was to show the interplay between commercial recordings and folk tradition, and how one might actually influence the other and have a bearing on the other. There was a school of thought back in the day that a folk tradition was or should be fairly pure and uncontaminated by anything commercial. But in real life, it doesn't work that way. And a musician in the mountains might go out and get the latest Jimmy Rogers record, learn it, put his or her own spin on it, and send it back out into tradition. There was a lot of give and take. And he went out to interview people. He listened to recordings. He listened to the words on recordings. He found musicians and really traced that back and forth process. One of the early articles he did, which is still a landmark article, was called Hillbilly Music Source and Symbol, where he spent many pages trying to figure out where did the combination of words hillbilly plus music first appear and why did it first appear. Later on, when he got more into public folklore and wanted to present the voices of musicians themselves, he edited a number of recordings, LPs usually, and promoted the preservation of music through ethnographic documentation and the presentation of it through recordings, through concert series, which he initiated here early on and did trial runs at Illinois, for example, with the Hobart Smith concert.
While he was a student or teaching or both?
While he was teaching here and on the Labor Institute staff.
He had a book very late in life called The Big Red Songbook. Mm-hmm. What can you tell me about that?
There was a series of so-called Little Red Songbooks that the IWW, the International Workers of the World, known as the Wobblies, put out from 1909 to 1973, if I remember right. And many songs and many variants. And Archie set out to do a compendium of all of the songs. And he wrote them all up, published them in one book, and there are essays by various people, discographies. It's a massive book that the Charles H. Kerr Publishing House, a radical publisher in Chicago, brought out in 2007. And not all the songs went into tradition, but Archie valued them because they had been written by workers, and the workers had a definite cause in mind, whether it was rousing the rabble or raising spirits or protesting working situations, things the Wobblies really would have cared about deeply. And Archie thought it would be a tribute not only to the Wobblies, but to the people who composed the songs, sang some of them, and thought enough of them to issue these Little Red Songbooks to do a master version of that.
Hence the Big Red Songbook.
Hence the Big Red Songbook,
that was
yes.
2007, and that was, according to the notes I have here anyway, featuring the lyrics specifically of those songs.
Mm-hmm.
Not is the music also in
I don't believe there's much music in there. Usually these songs were sung to the tune of some familiar song, fill in the blank, so that if people knew the basic song or hymn, whatever it might have been, you didn't need the music, and most of those folks couldn't read music anyway, so why bother?
Sure. Was Archie Greene any kind of musician himself?
Not really. No, once sang me a few little snippets that he had learned in the CCC camp in 1939, but it was kind of under his breath.
And CCC is?
The Civilian Conservation Corps. He did road building and firefighting in California after he got his degree from Berkeley and before he went into the shipyards and out into the Navy. But some of the guys out in the CCC camps would sing. And I remember one he sang was The Dehorn's Nose is Deepest Red, and I'm not going to go on with it. But.
You're not going to sing it for us?
No. I sing less than Archie does, which is not at all.
Stephen Wade, you've done just, I'm going to branch away from Archie Greene for a little bit, and because your own work interests me. You referred earlier to a one-man show you did back in the 70s. Called Banjo Dancing and a couple of others.
It opened in 1979, and then it kept going, you know.
Yeah, tell me about that and a couple of the other projects you've
done
theatrically.
Well, I guess the most recent one is I wrote the music and directed the music to the world premiere of Zora Neale Hurston's Polk County, the 1944 play. We had 22 people in the cast and some real traditional musicians there, and that was, we did that in Washington, and it was a was a wonderful experience.
Was that a one-off, or is that destined for other performances?
I don't know what its future is, but it was a large and complicated and long show. It was, you know, a large cast thing and so forth. I can't tell you what the future of that is. It's gone on from my hands, but that was the beginning of it for that. And the New York Times really loved it and stuff like that, so I was pleased by that. And Washington, above all, the Washington people came, and it was always sold out in a large theater. And we had, Rena gave me enormous freedom and a big budget to work with, so I could hire some wonderful musicians. And I had, there was no score or anything in Zora's play. There were some suggestions of songs. And I just sort of went from that, and I had a trombone player from the United House of Prayer. And you may have heard that or seen the book God's Trombones by James Alton Johnson. That this is really the living tradition of that, this trombone player. That's what they do. Instead of having like baseball teams in their church, they have these trombone bands, and the kids play music, and they grow up in playing this music. And his father played this music, and this man, Norvis Miller, plays this music, and his son Butch plays this music, and they worship through music in their church. Judy and I have been to their church in Anacostia, or one of their churches there, and music is part of how that sacrament is experienced, and it's an extraordinary thing. And there's glossolalia that goes on, or talking in tongues and things, and it's a very powerful thing. But the music, it pushes, and the repetition of it becomes a driving kind of experience. So I had and he's about as big as a Statue of Liberty, this guy. And so when he stood up, and I had him stand up at the end of the play, and then the whole audience is standing there. It was amazing. And I had John Cephas, who recently passed away, playing the guitar and singing, a wonderful blues singer. And his partner Phil Wiggins was playing the harmonica, and is a really adept musician. And I had a terrific piano player, and Daryl Davis by name, and he great hands on the piano, and he leads a band in Washington, and then I worked with all the actors and their singing, and it was just it's a complicated thing, but it was a wonderfully rich experience. As for myself, in the mid-1970s, Ray Nordstrand, who was the president of WFMT in Chicago and the founder of Chicago Magazine, suggested to me that I do a one-man show a la Mark Twain, Hal Holbrook's Mark Twain. I had discovered early on in performing that I needed to do something more than play the banjo to hold an audience's attention in a Chicago saloon. And I had started playing, as I mentioned, Fleming Brown, who recorded Hobart Smith and whose banjo I'm holding. Well, he had learned from a man named Doc Hopkins, and Doc Hopkins had, and that was his first name, was Dr. Howard Hopkins. He was a seventh son of family, 12 boys, and that was the healer. And so he was from Possum Hollow, Kentucky, Wallens Creek, Kentucky, in Harlan County. And he'd come up to Chicago in 1930 to play on the National Barn Dance. And he was on that radio show for 22 years. He was getting hundreds of thousands of pieces of mail a month, and that's how they measured popularity back then. Doc taught Fleming in the 1940s. Fleming taught me, and then when I started performing as a teenager, I was Doc's sideman. So I had a father and a grandfather in this music, very directly, two men who very much cared about me and who I loved very much and were not afraid to tell me when I was really playing badly. And when Fleming would say, well, that sounds like a piano falling down a staircase or something like that. And so I had them, and they both said at some point, okay, now you have to go out on your own. And I found myself learning pieces of, comic 19th century and 20th century literature from the Federal Writers Project and stuff like that, that I would memorize and perform while I played the banjo. And then I learned to clog dances, percussive dance underneath it, in addition to some singing. And so eventually this was formulating sort of like a one-man show in a bar, but it really that wasn't the context. And Ray Nordstrand perceived that. And in 19, I had some nice reviews from Melody Maker in England and John Wilson, New York Times and stuff. And gave those. He said, go to this off-loop theater in Chicago. It's called the Body Politic. It was the first off-loop theater in Chicago, and Paul Sills had named it for the man who founded Second City. And I brought in those reviews, and they sort of looked at that, and then made some calls to see if I was really adequate for them. And they said, okay, you could be the last show of the season in 1979. So it's booked for 3 weeks. At the end of their season in May 79, and what happened was that Cinderella story for me, lightning strikes. It was amazing because who would have known that the National Drama Critics Convention was going to meet in Chicago that spring? And they'd all go to it. They say, well, the show to go to is this kid play the banjo over there at the Body Politic. So lots of things happened overnight, really. And
that was the show called Banjo Dancer.
Yes, and it went from there to another theater in Chicago. It ran 57 weeks, sold out, and a couple hundred thousand people came, and I played at the White House for Jimmy Carter during that experience, and was in Time Magazine, all these great things, and then it went on and on and on. And I eventually came to Washington, D.C. to play at the Arena Stage for what was a three-week run. And I was there for 10 years and 2 weeks, so it was a long 3 weeks. And I wound up making up another one-man show. I did that in Chicago also, called On the Way Home, and won the Jeff Award there and stuff like that. And you've
done a show on Hobart Smith.
Actually, yes. When I wrote, so I put together a band. It took four of us to do what he could do all by himself, by the way. So I put together a band, and I wrote this thing out. It's 3 hours long, and I had a slideshow in the middle of all these pictures I gathered, and I did a different show every place we did it. And where I did it were places where he had played. So the greatest experience of that, we did it in Chicago at the Old Town School where he had been, and brought in people who were there that night as to part of that, brought them on stage too, and they had presentations to make, and did it in... And Washington did in Philadelphia Folk Festival, where Hobart had played himself. But the best place was when I did it in Saltville, and his family came.
Saltville,
Virginia. And that was amazing. And I knew his family. I'd been interviewing and knowing his family for many years because just of my interest in Hobart's music, because Fleming said, that's the hottest banjo player. If you want to do solo banjo, that's the man. So I had come to know them over the years in the past. And so it was really a wonderful experience to get to go there. And the whole town came out, or seemingly. And it was a great experience for me. And they put and what part of this was restorative, I think, because they... It's sort of local memory, kind of forgotten about him, and now he's in their town brochure, his picture, and they embrace him again, and they're proud of him, and they have reason to be. And I suggested to them, well, why don't we do a museum exhibit? They have this little museum of the Middle Appalachians down there, and so he's on permanent exhibition down there, and it was just great.
In Saltonville, Virginia.
Yeah.
We have... About 7 minutes left on the show, and you brought along another recorded sample pertinent to Archie Greene, who we began talking about, and we'll come back to. And you still have your banjo, so I'll leave it to you where we go musically with these few minutes.
Well, we talked about Archie in labor lore and industrial lore and the experiences of the industrial worker, and he always credited a Pennsylvania journalist by the name of George Corson, who was a union journalist, wasn't he, Judy? Who, in the 1920s, began writing about in Pennsylvania where he was, about the coal miners there, and this is a ballad by an actual coal miner from there about an thing that happened. It was in September 1867, I think, the Avondale mine disaster. It's one of the worst. Mine caught fire, and many people were killed. And when they found the bodies, there was a father holding his son and things like that. I went there some years back, and trying to find where the mine opening was. I went on this road where someone said it was, and there's these kids all driving by in a fast. They were driving by pretty darn fast, and I said, "Where was the Avondale mine disaster?" And every arm pointed out the window at the spot, and then it zoomed on. I mean, this is echoes, you know, a century, more than a century later. And this is a song by, he's sung, it's called The Avondale Mine Disaster, sung by John J. Quinn. And this is, again, to an old melody, and this is something that Archie cared about. And this is from an anthology I put together called A Treasury of Library of Congress Field Recordings. And this was a song that Archie was interested in, The Avondale Mine Disaster.
Good Christians, all both great and small, I pray you lend an ear and listen with attention while the truth I will declare. When you hear this lamentation, will cause you to weep and wail about the suffocation in the mines of Avondale. On the 6th day of September, 1869, those miners all then got a call to go work in the mine. But little did they think that death would soon prevail before they would return again from the mines of Avondale. The woman and their children, their hearts were filled with joy to see their men go to their work, likewise every boy. But a dismal sight and broad daylight soon made them turn pale when they saw the breaker burning o'er the mine.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was just reading these notes that I wrote, that I forgot about, here from the Treasury. And it says here, and maybe it'll give us sort of some of the context of this song, which is several minutes longer than we had time to play just now. But it's here, on September 6, 1869, a fire broke out at the Avondale Colliery about 20 miles south of Scranton, Pennsylvania. Stray sparks from the ventilating furnace ignited the lining of the 237-foot shaft, the mine's sole entrance. Whatever fresh air there was in the mine, wrote an 1869 edition of Harper's Weekly, went to feed the fierce flame while the sulfurous gases, having no longer an outlet, were forced back into the chambers and galleries of the colliery. As a result, 108 miners suffocated. An effort to locate survivors caused even more fatalities. And once fresh air was pumped in to dispel the afterdamp, 67 of the exhumed miners were discovered in a heap, including a father and a son held in an embrace. Avondale caught the nation's attention. So we had a lot of, I think certain industrial safety regulations came out of that. That's the kind of things that Archie was watching. I guess I'll just try to play a quick piece here, I guess from Hobart Smith. This is a tune he played called the Patteroller Song, which is really a human chase song, and that's another story we'll get to another time.
By Hobart Smith, called
Patteroller,
and performed here by Stephen Wade, who is going to be giving a presentation, playing sort of a mini one-man show. Well, except
not quite
one-man, because we have Jordan Kay and the Prairie Dogs.
That's right.
a several-man show, part of the tribute this evening to Archie Green, and that is going to be at the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois tonight from 7 to 9. And if you want more information, feel free to Call me here at the station. It's 244-2619. And let us know about your events coming up. We won't have a calendar today. We'll resume that tomorrow. willcalendar@illinois.edu. My other guest on the show, also Judy McCullough, formerly of the University of Illinois Press and longtime friend of Archie Green's. And on the show tomorrow, baritone Nathan Gunn and pianist Julie Gunn, who are giving a recital at the Krannert Center this Thursday evening. Our programs today on FM 90.9 are made possible by Parkland Art Gallery at Parkland College, seeking to expand appreciation of various art forms, promote the development of artist talent, and encourage aesthetic awareness. The gallery's exhibitions and educational programs are offered free of charge to the public. News headlines in just a moment. The forecast calls for a mostly sunny afternoon, the high 82. Tonight, partly cloudy. The low 58. Tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny with a high of 82. This is WYLL, FM and HD Urbana, operating translators W293 AF Danville and W266 AF Urbana. We're the listener-supported broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois.